You're listening to Saxon's Creed Radio Show. I'm David James, and I'm your host. Greetings to all the tribes of Israel who are the Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, Scandinavian, and Nordic peoples, our brothers and sisters around the world. Well, it's good to be back with you, ladies and gentlemen, today. Let me take a sip of my lemonade. The title of this message is The Serpentine Fire. Yes, this brings us full circle to the first show, where I never got to finish telling you one of the great questions I had had about the Bible. I had wondered why Yahweh had Moses put the serpent up on, you know, on the pole. I thought it was, I didn't understand it. It didn't make sense to me. And then later it was talked about that was a representation of Yeshua on the cross. Okay, well, we will see. I'm going to read in B.F. Jackson's Mystery of the Serpent. And we learned a lot of things in the first show. If you've never heard my first show, it's called Are You Blessing Vampires? And I read from this very book, and it was very revealing. It revealed the Kahila, the whole serpent, how it runs worldwide, who are the parts of the serpent, and the makeup of the Kahila. But it reveals much more than that. I also wanted to thank those who donated to help me in my work. If you wish to donate, you can go to davidjamesboston.com and you'll find a donate button there. I appreciate it. I do need help in my work, and I appreciate those who've helped me already. I leave it in your capable consciences. Okay, so I'm excited about this message. I really am. Because this book, I think this book is gold. Supposedly there's 5 books that he was supposed to have written, and I do have a second one, but it's not the actual book itself. And I know that at least one or two more exist, but there's no way to get a hold of them. If somebody has them, they're hoarding them to themselves, and God knows why. Okay, I'm going to start right on, excuse me again, a little more lemonade, please. Okay, I'm going to start on page 16. We observe, therefore, when Moses cast his shepherd's staff upon the ground, divine power changed it into the Ankh, as the scepter of the high priest of the order of Melchizedek, which God conferred upon Moses. The voice of that Ankh was a crackling sound of cosmic electricity running over it. That power was the Nakash, or serpent, which frightened Moses because he was shocked by its spiritual force. In Exodus 7, verse 9, 10, and 12, however, Moses cast the ankh upon the ground in front of the Pharaoh, and the cosmic energy changed it into a serpent. That word serpent originally was tannin. It means a howling dragon, a howling lizard, which makes a noise similar to choke you. In Numbers 21:6 and Deuteronomy 8:15, are fiery serpents. That word fiery in the Hebraic is sereth. It means burning, blazing. Sometimes it is seraphim. Both have the same meaning as something hot. That word serpent is nakash and is written without the bars and dots under the last two characters. Written thus, and by close study of the chapters, one observes that the serpent is an enchanter, something which enchanted the people. In Deuteronomy 8:15, the Hebraic for the word scorpion is akrab, which is just an ordinary scorpion. Yet the serpents are not snakes. It holds for Exodus 21:6 and 7. What then are the fiery serpents sent by God to bite and kill the people? That was a question. What then are the fiery serpents sent by God to bite and kill the people? That word fiery as a seraph and the serpents as nakash or enchanter are the clues providing the fiery serpents are heat waves caused by sun heating radiating, sun heat radiating from the dry ground, which when observed from a distance formed into a shimmering, undulating mirage or mirages, seraphim. That unfamiliar spectacle enchanted nakash are Israelite progenitors, and they received sunstroke and were dangerously blistered by the tremendous summer heat after the people spoke against God and Moses and refused to get in the shade of their tents. Is that not interesting? It certainly is an explanation. Let's just put it that way. Moses warned them to keep in the shade during the heat of the day. You know, one thing I was saying to somebody, I believe it was even just yesterday. Yeah, I believe it was Eli I was saying this to. Is that the funny thing about our race, it is peculiar, is that we're stiff-necked. We're stiff-necked against our own people. We're stiff-necked against Yahweh. But we have no backbone when it comes to the serpent. We're not stiff-necked to the devil. We're not stiff-necked to the serpent, his children. And that is very peculiar. To me, especially, I can't understand it for the life of me. We'd rather fight one another than fight our enemies. We'd rather fight Yahweh than obey, when it's just simpler to obey. Why is that, ladies and gentlemen? I really don't have an answer. I don't know why we don't amalgamate, that we don't stick together. Eventually we will, but I don't know what it is that keeps us apart. I suppose it's like the stars in heaven. There are light dots all over the sky, and what keeps them apart? The void, darkness. That's what keeps us apart, I'm sure. Because if our lights shone much brighter, the shining of our lights would shine until we touched one another's lights, and there'd be no room for the void or the darkness, would there? Until that time, I suppose this great separation, isn't it funny, we don't mind living together in a neighborhood, but we're still separate. But we let people of other families of the earth live in our country, which we're not supposed to do. It's bizarre to me. But anyway, let's continue on. See, Moses was warning them, hey, get inside the tent. It's hot out here, and, you know, this will cause you sickness. And, of course, they don't want to listen, you know what I mean? Rebellious. They're rebellious. Like many of our women today, and like many of our men today, rebellious. Moses warned them to keep in the shade during the heat of the day, but the stiff-necked people ignored him and remained outdoors to look at the enchanting mirages constantly changing from one spectacle to another. Many of the people died from sunstroke and severe sunburn. Those not dying yet were weakened with high fever, appealed to Moses to save them. He could have used his power and cured them, but it would have been useless. They were so rebellious that, as soon as they had been cured, they would have again defied him. I would not doubt that. To convince them he knew what he was talking about, he let them suffer and learn the hard way. Very interesting. Now that is very interesting. Think about it today. We are suffering. We are stiff-necked to Yahweh and his laws and his commands. We are stiff-necked to one another. We know everything, see? And if we found out we didn't know something, well, we could never admit it because that would mean we were wrong. Imagine you would have to admit you were wrong. Oh, my goodness, this is terrible. So, in the same way, today, I'm going to read that sentence again, or that little part. They were so rebellious, just think of what I'm saying, this is today too, they were so rebellious that as soon as they had been cured, they would have again defied him. To convince them he knew what he was talking about, he let them suffer and learn the hard way. They would not rely on him for anything when the going got tough. Without something to look at and remind them of Moses' warning to remain in the shade during the heat of the day, they would go their headlong way and continue exposing themselves to sunstroke and sunburn while declaring they were rugged enough not to be hurt. Rugged enough not to be hurt. You know, they could do it themselves, you see. Each man knows, you know, thinks he knows his own way. Therefore, in Numbers 21:9, in the record where Moses installed a brass serpent on a pole in the center of the camp, that word serpent is Nakash in the original. Moses, however, did not install it for the people to worship. See, this is what I was wondering. I'm saying to myself, okay, I'll explain why I say this. It's because later in the Bible, one of the good kings, King Hezekiah, the people were worshiping these brass serpents. And basically, I said to myself, well, why would Yahweh do something like that? Why would he put something up? Knowing, because he would know, that later the people would be worshiping these things. Well, King Hezekiah, he destroyed them. Same way as I would be. If I were king or if I were president, I'd have all those things smashed down. There would be no Hindu temples in America. There would be no synagogues in America. There would be no mosques in America. There would be no statues in America. You know, the woman with her torch, that would be busted right down. No Catholic churches in America. So if you don't want that to happen, don't ever make me president. Okay. So let me go on here. Okay, so Moses, however, did not install it for the people to worship and appeal to cure snake bit, as many Christian clergymen have preached. Snake bite. He missed the E there. Sorry. Okay, I don't know what it is with the these things. I guess as humans we make errors. Okay, so these Christian clergymen from the Jewish version of Christianity have preached that, so what he's saying, Moses, however, did not install it for the people to worship and appeal to for a cure for snake bites, as many Christian clergymen have preached, or ignored it because the idea of it was that of an idol. Now, idol worship is forbidden by God, as we know, by Yahweh. He does not want us to have any idols. He does not want us to have any statues or any of that stuff. To preach it as an idol, which God told Moses to install, would be contrary to his word. See, this is what I was saying. Why would he do something like that? It didn't make sense to me. And this is the first explanation I've ever seen like this. And it's very intriguing, and I think it does answer the question. Let's move along with it. Therefore, that portion of our scriptures is ignored by many clergymen. The occults have seized hold of that serpent and declare our Israelite progenitors worshipped the Ophidian god, who is Satan, symbolized as the serpent of divine wisdom. And our God gave approval. See, it's contradictory. Inasmuch as Yahweh told Moses to set it up, the Ophites declare the tribal God of Israel knows Satan is more powerful than he. Yeah. Yahweh, however, never told Moses to install an image of the Ophite devil. In Numbers 21:8 is where he tells Moses to install the fiery serpent. That serpent is a Nakash, and it means an enchanter in the original Hebraic text. The word fiery is seraphim. He's reviewing here. What then is that serpent? It is nothing more than a flat or concave polished brass disc to serve as a thermometer installed in the middle of the camp so that it could be observed from any angle. When it became hot in the sun and its temperature increased as the sun approached the zenith, heat waves, seraphim, began radiating from it. Interesting, ladies and gentlemen. At the maximum temperature, the radiation would be so intense, one looking at it would see a spectacle as though the radiated heat was water pouring in every direction, similar to the water flowing down the outer surface of a glass window pane, while one looks at it from the inside of the room. When our progenitors saw that fiery radiation, it was a solemn warning that the temperature out in the sun rays was too intense, and they had better get in their tents and remain until the heat slacked off in the late afternoon. That time was indicated when the brass enchanter ceased radiating. Those formerly receiving minor sunstroke and sunburn were cured by remaining in their tents. See, it's a very simple explanation, is it not? But of course, the question, and there's nothing wrong with wanting to know the answer to that question. I had that very question. And Yahweh always answers your questions. If you have questions, ladies and gentlemen, ask Yahweh. You can ask other people too, of course. Do some research. Ask Yahweh. If you can't find an answer to a question, ask Yahweh to show you that answer. And, you know, you may not get it the first day. You may not get it. You just never know when it's going to come. And it usually comes when you least expect it, but all of a sudden you're like, there's the answer. It doesn't usually take that long. So it's just that simple. Let's continue on. I do not know how high the temperature rises in the Arabian Desert in summer, but Mr. W.B. Seabrook, in his book, Adventures in Arabia, says that it is so severe that one will even blister in the shade of a moving motor car. Whoa. To prevent it, it is necessary for white men to wear heavy woolen clothes. He says he preferred being parboiled that way rather than roasted with light summer clothes on. Okay. On the plains of Cambodia, French Indochina, I have experienced during the dry season a temperature rise of 150 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade. In the open sun rays, the temperature is so intense, the exposure to it is similar to one walking into an open fire. So it's like that when you go into a fire, he's saying, okay? And the flaming fiery serpents, seraphim, are very much alive and active on the distant landscape. They are mirages produced by heat waves rising from the dry ground. They form in various shapes. Occasionally, they seem to be a waterfall or cataract, except the water falls upward. On the occasions they seem to be a lake, on other occasions, they seem to be a lake of shimmering silver. Other times they seem to be millions of headless white snakes chasing one another over the landscape. Occasionally, one seems to see a high wave of shimmering molten glass rapidly approaching. There still lingers in Anglo-Saxondom an old saying that the sun heat waves are lazy Lawrence. Ha ha, lazy Lawrence. Obviously, the expression has come down from our progenitors. 40 years of probation in the Arabian and Sinai deserts, Sinai, when they lazed around their tents during the heat of the summer days. In modern steel mills, those same fiery burning serpents, seraphim, can be observed in the blast furnaces when the temperature reaches a certain degree of white heat. You know, white heat, right? Now listen to what he's saying now. Now, you saw a criminal movie. Yeah. See, you know, one of these criminal movies, you know, that was put out. It was called White Heat. And, of course, criminals are snakes. So I thought of that right away when I had seen that before, and it just came right back to me again. I forget that guy's name, but he's a short guy, and he's a little snake. But anyway, so he says that when the temperature reaches a certain degree of white heat, they are a glowing red color. Whereas the main fire is white, they resemble big fat lizards about 12 inches long. They are known to steel workers as fire lizards. Now, this is interesting. You got to admit, this is very interesting. Now, this lazy Lawrence thing, I think that we should find out what that means. That sounds very interesting. So what he's saying here is, in these modern steel mills, you can see these same serpents that you see out on the desert in the mirages. That's how hot the heat is. And all of a sudden, when these furnaces in these steel mills reach a certain degree of white heat, they are now glowing a red color. And now these certain kind of snakes resemble big fat lizards about 12 inches long. I've never heard anybody say this stuff before. They're known to steel workers as fire lizards. So if you know a steel worker, which you probably don't because they've killed that industry in America as far as I know, you could ask them about fire lizards. The same fiery serpents are again observed in Isaiah 30, verse 6, in Deuteronomy 32, verse 24. However, the serpent is a snake. In the original manuscript, it is Zakel. The word can be used for snake, a worm, or to be afraid. In 2 Kings 18:4 is the record of King Hezekiah destroying the brass thermometer. There it is, okay? So remember that, 2 Kings 18, verse 4. There's that good king. He was one of the few good kings from the tribes of Israel. He was doing what Yahweh wanted. He destroyed. Now listen why, okay? So in 2 Kings 18:4 is the record of King Hezekiah destroying the brass thermometer made by Moses because the people still believed it contained life and it was an object of worship to them. You see why I would question that? You see why I would say, well, why would Yahweh have Moses put this serpent up on a pole and then knowing later that the people would be worshiping those things? Why would he do something like that? It just doesn't make sense. Well, now it makes sense, does it not? In Psalms 140, verse 1, the word man is Adam in the original. It graphically shows the men of Israel's household are of the Adamic race. They had sharpened their tongues like a serpent. Verse 3. That word sharpened is latash, or to instruct. The word serpent is nakash, and written with bars and dots to show he is of Satan's race. Any instruction coming from that source is the philosophy of hate. It is denoted in the word poison, which is chema, or heat, fury, or anger. The word adder, you know, the snake adder, is akashub, which is the female viper in Matthew 3, verse 7, and correlating passages. She is Kali. That's supposedly the wife of the devil, Kali, according to Dr. Wesley Swift. We just heard that last week, I believe. So it says she is Kali, the poisonous female of Jewry's beast system. In Proverbs 23:32, the serpent and the adder are the same as in Psalms 140, verse 3. The serpent in Proverbs 30:19, however, is the enchanting, quivering waves caused by rocks radiating the sun heat. It is denoted by the word serpent, and it is Nakash, and is written without bars and dots under the last two characters in the original Hebraic. In Ecclesiastes 10, verse 8 and 11, or through 11, or yeah, the serpent is Nakash, and is written with the bars and dots to show he is of Satan's counterfeit race. It is further denoted in the word hedge in verse 8, which is gader in the Hebraic. It means a wall as one's protection in the law. The word bite in both verses is nashak, or to lend upon usury. Ha ha ha! Yes. Surely the son of Satan will lend upon usury without enchantment. Verse 11. When one breaks the law, he loans on usury as our bail bond brokers. In Isaiah 65, verse 25, the serpent is Nakash and is written with dots and bars to prove he is the cursed race of Jews, soon to be banished from Israel's Christian world. The wolf symbolizes people in the house of Israel who have not accepted Christ Jesus, whereas the lamb are those who accepted him. The lion symbolizes the Lion of Judah, and the bullock symbolizes Ephraim, who is England. The straw, which they are going to eat together, is clean, uncontaminated peace after the serpent race of Jews has been banished from Christendom to eat dust for the next 1,000 years. That word dust is afar, or rubbish, which will be the spiritual, mental, and material food of Jewry exiled out in Mongolia and Tibet, from whence his ancestral father, Cain, came when he went into the land of Nod, which means wandering in the Hebraic. So the land of Nod means wandering. In Jeremiah 8:17, you know, we may wish to look at that verse to see just what it says, Ecclesiastes 10:8. Let me see if I can whip that up. Just give me a moment, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see what this verse says. Okay. We're going to have to find it here. Ecclesiastes. I'm sorry for the... But this will should be worth it. I want to see what that exactly says. Ecclesiastes 10:8. I'm looking it up in Bible Works. What it says is, he that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh through a fence, a serpent shall bite him. The next verse, verse 9, whoso heweth out stones shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaveth wood is endangered thereby. Verse 10. If the iron be blunt, and one do not what the edge, then must he put more to strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct. And then in verse 11, which he spoke about, surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and babbler is no better. Very interesting. So what he said was the serpent biting without enchantment means the usury. Now that's very interesting, I think. Okay, so let's go over here and let's see. In Isaiah 65:25, the serpent is Nakash, and written with dots and bars to prove he is the cursed race of Jews, soon to be banished from Israel's Christian world. Oh, I read this right. The wolf symbolizes the people in the house of Israel who have not accepted Christ Jesus, whereas the lambs are those that accepting him. The lion symbolizes the lion of Judah, and the bullock symbolizes Ephraim, who is England. And the straw, which they are going to eat together, is clean, uncontaminated peace after the serpent race of Jews has been banished from Christendom. Okay, so in Jeremiah 8:17, the serpents and cockatrices are the same counterfeit race of the devil. In Isaiah 14:29 is a prophecy for this era. The serpent is Nakash, and written with the bars and dots to prove that he is of Satan's serpent race of Jews. Isaiah says its offspring would be a poisonous cockatrice. It was a female. During Isaiah's time, she was called Ishtar. Today she has adopted her original Hindu name of Kali. She is the deadness in Jewry's blood system. As the vampire of that counterfeit race, she is the adder in Psalms 58:3 and 4. The viper in Matthew 3:7, 12 verse 34 and 23 verse 33. Luke 3 verse 7. The woman in Zechariah 5:7 and Revelation 17:1-6, notwithstanding the Jew lie that the latter is the Roman Catholic Church. Yes, so that's who is the woman is riding the beast, according to this man. That's why I said that it's Jewry. It literally is Jewry. They are the fake Israel. And she's holding a cup. So this is Kali. Okay? Who's riding the serpent? Who's riding the beast? In Revelation 17:1-6. The serpent in Isaiah 14:29 was the Luciferian priesthood and Satan in Babylon from 721 to 330 BC. A relative of theirs exalted himself as God in India in 600 BC. He was the king of Naga, or serpent race, in that land. Since time immemorial, the king of the serpent race has been the current eldest son of the eldest son of the original crown prince of hell. He was worshipped as Lucifer, yet called God. But he is no god, ladies and gentlemen. He's just a wannabe. The record of one exalting himself as God in 600 BC is the first secular record of an exaltation in India, whereas his record of the in the Hindu scriptures goes back about 35,000 BC, when Enoch of the Adamic line of Seth says in his messianic prophecy, Satan first came out of the dimension of spirit, a counterfeit material beast, making his appearance amidst man contrary to divine law. Now we do see, though, that in the book of Adam and Eve that I wrote you, the devil made an appearance on earth to both Adam and Eve. And the devil deceived Eve yet again. Some people say it's the devil who deceived her in the garden. Some people say it's Gadrael. However, when they spoke, one thing I will say is that she said she got fooled again. And when she got out of the water, she was doing her penitence, and she was fooled by the devil, and she got out of the water, and they went over to where Adam was, and Adam immediately was disappointed, and he said, she said, the devil fooled me again. So there's some circumstance that maybe in the garden, this is the same exact devil that fooled her yet again. Very interesting. This is interesting stuff. I think it would be nice if we went over the scriptures. Maybe Eli and I should do this together, because one could read the scriptures and then you could, you know, go back and forth and say what that means. You could really study this on a deeper level and have a deeper understanding of it. Okay, so he says in Isaiah 14:29, is so big we have to stand at a distance to observe it, from Psalm 58, 3 and 4, on through the book of Revelation, and verify it by the serpent's own record. At this occasion, however, we will not dwell on Isaiah 14:29 any further than to observe the meaning of the Hebrew words which say, rejoice not, thou whole Palestine, because the rod of him that smote thee is broken. For out of the serpent's root come a cockatrice, and his or her fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent. The original word for that word rod is shebet. It is a scepter. It is the original caddy. I don't even know how to say this. Caduceus, yes, as the emblem of Kali's power. Caduceus, yes, that's it. I haven't seen that spelled out for a while, so sorry about that. So the caduceus is the emblem of Kali's power, the emblem of witchcraft or occult science. The first serpent is Nakash. It is written with the bars and dots under the last two characters. Written thus, it proves he is of Satan's serpent race of Jew vampires. The word root is shorka, bottom. It is the bottomless pit of hell in the upside-down floor of the synagogue of Satan. The word cockatrice is tsepha. It is an adder or viper, which seems to be an ordinary snake. It would, if not connected with Satan's serpent race. When connected with the race, we know that the cockatrice is the whoring mother spirit or the vampire condition of Jewry's bloodstream. The fruit of that cockatrice is peri. It means a branch. The word fiery is seraph, burning one. The word flying is up, U-P-H, to be faint, be weary, flee away, wax faint. The second serpent is Saraf, a burning, fiery, stinging. Yes, she will be a burning, fiery, stinging reptile. She is Kali, the prostituting, blood-drunk mother spirit of a race of religious cutthroats and murderers. As the material or masculine cockatrice, he is, see, the devil, that's what I keep telling people, and I haven't had much resistance to it because I think everybody realizes it's true, that the devil, when you see a female goddess in across the world, you know that that's the devil. And when you see a male god, you know that that's the same kind of a thing. These aren't real gods. He's a wannabe god. He never will be God. Okay. But what I mean by that is these other people worship him as God. So to them, he is a god. To us, he is garbage. So, he is hermaphrodite. You know, he's both male and female. We see a lot of that going on today. That's just another of the many hybrids, right? You're seeing that worldwide that I had told you before, that people had come up to me and said, have you ever noticed that you see some people these days and you can't tell whether they're male or female? I think you know what I'm talking about, ladies and gentlemen. So, you see Baphomet, and he's got women's breasts, and you see that he's also a male. So, I mean, it makes sense. It makes sense that yes, Kali is the female, and this cockatrice is the male. So what he's saying here is, as the material or masculine, cockatrice he is the Ashkenazim Khazar Jews in Christendom and the black Zuhu Jews of Asia, in who the satanic force of the night-prowling vampire Kali, the female cockatrice of Jewry's serpent system. With that whoring spirit within them, they pretend to be faint, always weary because they are persecuted. To hear them tell it, just because they are unfortunate to be Jews, they flee from justified punishment when their sabotage and destruction smacks them in the face. They wax faint after every pogrom. They press on with one thought constantly burning within them, a fiery, stinging, spiritually depraved sense of revenge against people. Ladies and gentlemen, you know that's true. This revenge against people who formerly gave them sanctuary out of pity, refuse to bow to Jewry and lower themselves to his level, then surrender to that counterfeit race and permit it to rule supreme with its subjects clamped in the so-called benevolence of Talmudic slavery. This is where we are today, in Talmudic slavery. Okay? See, the Jew knows one thing. I told you this, and I'm going to remind you this again. When the Jew's on top, he is the most merciless, cruel, arrogant, vicious leader that there could be. And he will kill without no tears at all. But when the Jew is on the bottom, he is an actor. So he plays the part of being on the bottom, the part of the persecuted one. Oh, I'm so weary. I've been chased from land to land. No, we didn't do anything wrong. No, nothing at all. We don't deserve this treatment we're getting. Is he lying? Yes, of course he's lying. He's lying not only because of what he's saying, but because of what he's not saying. Do you understand that? Satan's serpent race bobs up again in Job 26. He is the same breed as the one in Isaiah 14:29. Another track is observed in Job 24 as the low chicanery of Satan's vampire race, whom Job calls he. Occasionally, and he is Satan as Bildad's god. Bildad and his companions are Cainite, Sabine serpent mongrels. But Job answered and said, good, he gives the scripture here. But Job answered and said, how have you, Bildad, helped him that is without power? How save you the arm that has no strength? Dead things are formed from under the waters, and from under the inhabitants thereof. Job 26, 1, 2, and 5. That compound word, or that compound word, dead things, which we have seen before with 2 Peter, remember? That compound word, dead things, is Rephaim in the original Hebrew. You've heard of the Star of Rephaim. Excuse me. It means the shades of spiritual and material death. It is the twice dead serpent race of Jew vampires. In Job 25, the word dominion is mashal, to cause to rule. Fear is pashad, dread. Peace is shalom, favor. The high places in Marom, a person is in authority. Light is or enlightened. Arise is kum, abide. Okay, I want to mention something here for a second. I want to just interject something. Did you notice that the Jews say shalom, which supposedly means peace, correct? Yet there is no peace with that people. And when they say peace, they really mean war. The blacks in America, and probably worldwide now, they always say peace. They don't say shalom. They say peace. But they really mean war. And the same goes for the Muslims. They say peace too, because they are Negro wannabes. Some people call them desert monkeys or you've heard all the terms. Sand Negro. Right? Well, it's because they see the Negroes and they want to be Negroes for some reason. I don't know. I couldn't understand why anyone would want to be a Negro. But, you know, I guess there's some people that just, I don't know. I can't figure that one out for the life of me. However, they all say peace, but they mean war. Do you understand that? Have you ever realized that? One says shalom and the other two say peace. You know, instead of saying goodbye or I'll see you later, or whatever it might be. Now you know what they mean by peace, because there is no peace in those races. Okay, this continues on. Thus, Bildad says his god, the Jew race, causes fear to rule when a Jew favors one in authority. Jewry's favors to man then and now is preceded with the lowest form of servility, boot licking, then loaning money to an individual or a government so as to obligate them to him. Yes. See, this is why we're not supposed to be lovers of gifts. And this is why we're not supposed to be borrowing from these people, because it turns you into a servant of these people, because now you owe them. It's the same principle when they give money to a congressman et al. And at this point, they don't want any usury. They want something else. And therefore, because you have received their gift, you now owe them. See? That's why it's important to not be a lover of gifts. Okay, let's continue. After securing that advantageous position, the Jew gradually puts forward hidden suggestions for various unnecessary projects which the superior non-Jew ultimately believes are necessary, and the initiative seems to be his. The projects are started, and he unconsciously does the very bidding of the Jew, whose slithering chicanery gradually undermines the business until it is damaged beyond repair before the superior awakens to what has occurred. That's a little like problem reaction solution, is it not? Perhaps he trusts the Jew to such an extent that he will never awaken to the truth. You could say that about the white race today. Perhaps he trusts the Jew to such an extent that he will never awaken to the truth. Think on that for a while. Perhaps he trusts the Jew. This could be speaking of the Adamic race. Not everyone, of course. Listen one more time. Perhaps he trusts the Jew to such an extent that he will never awaken to the truth. He takes the responsibility as being negligent for permitting his business to decline, and he discovers he is denied further credit at the bank that is presided over by another Jew, secretly in league with the traitor in his office. Now, I've just seen this happen to a company that I was working with. And what did the Jew that came into the company, what's the first thing he got a hold of? Can you guess, ladies and gentlemen, dear listeners, what position in the company do you think he might have got a hold of first? Well, yes, you guessed it right, the money. And then, within a very short period of time, he's got three other titles in the company. And now his wife works in the company. And all sort of Jew names began to show up in the company. I warned the owner of the company, who is not a Jew. Did he listen to me? No. What do you think will happen to his business? I already know what's going to happen. I can see this miles and miles away. Like the Who said, I can see for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. But that's only thanks to Yahweh. So, Satan then offers to reciprocate the former favors he received and offers to buy one's business in an apparent sincere effort to prevent one from becoming a total failure. See, this, what you're seeing here is this is an example on why the Jews have all the businesses around the world. This is the same scenario over and over. Let me give it to you again, because this is, I don't care if I take a few weeks on this book, because I just think it's filled with gold. Okay? Let's look at it again. It's really amazing. Okay. So what he does in the beginning is he gets himself an advantage and a position within a company, a white man's company. The Jew gradually puts forward hidden suggestions, right? This is problem, reaction, solution type of thing for various unnecessary projects. This cannot just be a business. This is a government. Okay. We see in our government today many unnecessary projects, do we not? So, is he gets himself into position. You see, as you play football, in order to catch the ball that is going to be thrown, you must get yourself in position. But let's forget about football, because I have. Anyway. So the Jew gets himself into the company, gets himself in position, makes all these suggestions. He's smiling to win all the while. You must realize he's smiling. Okay. He's going to get what he wants. And what he does is slowly by surely, he destroys the business of this man. But the man, what it says here is the man takes responsibility as being negligent. He blames himself, the white business owner. He blames himself for permitting his business to decline, and he discovers that he is denied further credit at the bank or the Federal Reserve or whatever it might be. And you see, the Jew in the bank is working with the Jew that's in his company. Do you understand? So when he gets the company destroyed to a point where it looks hopeless, the white owner goes on a guilt trip, blames himself. Oh, he's all done. His business is over. But the Jew comes to the rescue. Don't worry about it. I'll buy your business from you so as it won't be a total failure. So what it says here is Satan then offers to reciprocate the former favors he received and offers to buy one's business in an apparent sincere effort to prevent one from becoming a total failure. One has no alternative. The offer is generous. One accepts the offer, and one's work, created out of one's genius, passes into the parasitical hands of the blood-sucking vampire, who then goes to his brother Jew in the bank to refinance the business for speculative purposes. The traitorous beast then sells the property at an enormous profit while his former employer commits suicide because he believes he is a failure. The traitor and his banker brother then divide the loot between themselves in accordance with Lucifer's law in the Shulchan Aruch section of the Talmud, which we've heard of this before. The Shulchan Aruch section of the Talmud, which says, when a Jew makes a deal with a non-Jew and another Jew comes up and deceives the non-Jew, no matter in what manner, whether He gives him false measure or overcharges him. Then both Jews must share between them the profits thus sent by their God. On other occasions, when one becomes obligated to a Jew in any manner, and he learns one's weaknesses or discovers a secret which one is ashamed of and is desirous of keeping it out of the public cognizance, one is then in the power of the Luciferian reptile. This is what they said they would do in the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. They said that they would get the people that were in the press. They said that they would get the people that were in the governments, that they would have something on all of them, so that if they needed, it was a source of blackmail, but it was also a source of keeping them in line, doing what they want them to do. So that if one rebelled against the Jew, the secret would be told and they would be ruined. So, that's what he's talking about right here. Let me read it again. On other occasions, when one becomes obligated to a Jew in any manner, and he learns one's weakness or discovers a secret which one is ashamed of and is desirous of keeping it out of the public cognizance, one is then in the power of the Luciferian reptile. When the superior one is then in the power of the when the superior one awakens to the chicanery and takes measures to divest himself of the crawly influence, the Jew bears his poisonous serpent fangs and boldly demands to be given supreme power, or he will expose the secret to public view. If the superior defies the Jew, and the latter very piously gives information about the secret to the newspapers in what he declares is service to the public. See, the Jew's playing a hero while he's doing something very dastardly. He's always informing the public. He's telling the truth. See, when the Jew tells the truth, and that's very rare, there has to be something behind it. He's not doing it because he wants to tell the truth. He's doing it because he's going to portray himself as being something that he's not, while he destroys. If the superior defies the Jew, the latter very piously gives information about the secret to the newspapers in what he declares is service to the public. Another Jew then broadcasts it over the radio so as to kill the confidence of the public in the victim. The blind public does the rest and throws the good man out of office and destroys his public usefulness, while the hypocritical blackmailing Jew is held up as a public benefactor. I hope you are listening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope that you have, as I always say, German Shepherd ears, with your ears are pricked up. Ooh, I hope you're hearing. These snakes are just, it's just amazing to me, This guy's showing you exactly how it's done, and I hope you're paying attention to how your enemy works. So he goes on. When Satan has accomplished his dirty work, he then slithers into the vacant chair to suck his living out of our people if the occasion warrants it. If, however, it is not expedient for him to take the chair at that time, he suggests to other superior non-Jews, that a certain man, a non-Jew, is more capable than him to discharge the duties of the office. In that manner, Satan remains in darkness behind the the certain man, who is always of weak character and submits to the Jews' very bidding out of fear of losing his well-paid job or being character assassinated. In respect to Satan getting peace in high places of our government and nation, Dean Acheson, Secretary of State, and President Harry S. Truman are the certain men of whose sponsored conspiracy Senator Joseph McCarthy speaks of in the Congressional Record for 14th March 1951. Mr. Owen Lattimore, a Jew, the State Department's advisor, praised the State Department for having succeeded in allowing China to fall to the communists without letting it appear to the world that we had shoved it. It is almost incredible, but it is a matter of record. He then goes on to say, the thing to do, therefore, is also to let South Korea fall. But do not let it be known that we pushed her. Hence the recommendation for a parting grant of $150 million. The picture of Western Europe, Mr. President, is much the same. We are preparing to allow Western Europe to fall without having it appear that we pushed her. In other words, the present plan is strictly a phony plan for a phony defense, a case of those in the back rooms where the planning is done by the same crowd that did the planning for China, saying the same thing they said about China, namely, we will let them fall, but we will not let it appear that we pushed her. I want to remind you what Harry S. Truman said. I believe he's a Jew. He certainly was a Freemason, so he might as well be a Jew. It really doesn't matter. He is a Jew. He's either a Jew in heart and spirit, or he's a Jew in race, whichever. He said, right in the newspaper, that he didn't care if Germany won World War II or if Russia won, just as long as many of them died as possible. Are those not the words of a Jew? Who was dying? Who was he speaking of? Who was to die? White men. He did not care who won, just as long as many of them died as possible. Does that sound like something an Aryan man would say? These filthy, rotten snakes. Okay, let's continue on. In a cafe in Budapest, Hungary in 1919, the Jew Jacob H. Schiff revealed another phase of that beast system. It was published in the book Geneva Against Peace. Ladies and gentlemen, we must find this book, Geneva Against Peace, by Comte de Saint-Hilaire in 1936, in which he quotes Schiff. Now, you've heard of Jacob Schiff. He's the one that was sending money. He's a Rothschild protege. He was sending money to the Russian Revolution. Yes, through Woodrow Wilson. He's the one that was financing. I believe he sent the gold on the ship over there. So here's what it says when he quotes Schiff. The health of our golden calf, note the Jew, God of gold, demands that certain nations should be sick, namely those of themselves to develop. Take, for example, pre-war Turkey, the sick man, as it was called by diplomats, when helped to keep us healthy, which helped to keep us healthy. See, by them being sick, he's saying it helped to keep the Jews healthy. Let me just, I'm going to hang on this for a few minutes, this quote by Jacob Schiff. I want you to really get what he's saying. So he says, the health of our golden calf demands that certain nations should be sick. Okay? You know these nations would be nations that they are preying upon, that they are building their golden calf with. So the health of our golden calf demands that certain nations should be sick, namely those not of themselves to develop. Take, for example, pre-war Turkey, the sick man. This is what they called Turkey, the sick man, as it was called by diplomats, which helped to keep us healthy. See, by Turkey being sick, it was keeping the Jews healthy. From it, we received concessions of every description, banks, mines, harbors, railroads, etc. In short, its whole economical life was in our care. And we cared so well for it that it died, in Europe at least. How do you like this guy, Ain't he loving? How would you like to be in his care? How would you like to be in the care of a Jewish lawyer? How would you like to be in the care of a Jew doctor? How would you like to be in the care of a Jewish abortionist? How would you like to be in the care of a Jewish banker? How would you like to be in the care of a Jewish financial manager? Listen to what he said, and we cared so well for it that it died, in Europe at least. And then he goes on. Now that the accumulation of Turkey's wealth has become common property in the international Jew banking house of Rothschild, and that we have the fulfillment of our mission at hand of revealing to Christendom the fact that Jewry is Satan and the re-establishing the world empire of Satan, we need another sick man, another nation, ladies and gentlemen. This alone would have been sufficient reason, apart from higher consideration of annihilation of Christianity. But let me read this again. They want to annihilate Christianity. So, this alone would have been sufficient reason, apart from the higher consideration, for grafting Bolshevism onto Tsarist Russia. Russia is now the sick man of the post-war days, and it is much more nourishing than the Ottoman Empire. See, nourishing. It's these vampires are living off the host. I'm on page 23, ladies and gentlemen. How do you like to know your enemy? Aren't they wonderful? Aren't they delicious? To them, you are nutritious. I think we must learn soon, because the game, the sick man, now that I've learned that term, America is the current sick man, and so are all the white nations of Europe and South Africa and et al. And they're feasting on our blood. The only problem is once we are all destroyed, if it did happen, who would be the next sick man? Russia again? because then nobody could stand up with Russia and help them. Just like Germany had no help. Just think, Germany fought the whole world and almost won. That's how great their army was. You've been listening to Saxon's Creed Radio Show. I'm David James. Until next time, study to show thyself approved.
Kansas anymore.
Well, stay away from me, or I'll stuff a mattress with you. And you, I use you for a beehive.
I'm not afraid of her. I'll see you get safely to the wizard now, whether I get a brain or not. Stuff a mattress with me. Heh. I'll see you reach the wizard, whether I get a heart or not. Beehive, bah. Let her try and make a beehive out of me.
How about a little fire, Scarecrow?
Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my.
Lions, tigers, bears.
Oh, my. Lions
and... I'll get you, my pretty. And your little dog, too.
Why, you're nothing but a great big coward.
You're right. I am a coward. I haven't any courage at all.
Well, my little pretty, I can cause accidents too.
Well, you didn't have to go and hit me, did you? Is my nose bleeding?
Well, of course not. My goodness, what a fuss you're making.
Oh, what's happening? What is it? I can't run anymore. I'm so sleepy.
Let's get out of here. Look, Emerald City is closer and prettier than ever.
This is the spell, this is. It's the Wicked Witch. What do we do?
Help! Oh, so she is. Well, bust my buttons. Why didn't you say that in the first place? That's a horse of a different color. Come on in.
I am Oz. The great and powerful. Who are you?
Bring me the broomstick of the Witch of the West.
But if we do that, we'll have to kill her to get it.
Bring me her broomstick, and I'll grant your requests. Now go.
But what if she kills us first?
I do believe in spooks. I do believe in spooks. I do. I do. I do. I do. I do. I do believe in spooks. I do believe in spooks. I do. I do. I do. I do. I do. I do.
Let's get out of here. Look,
these things must be done delicately. Hear us. Why, my little party's just beginning.
Courage. What makes a king out of a slave? Courage. What makes the flag on the mast to wave? Courage.
I'm melting! Melting! Oh, what a world! What a world!
Do not arouse the wrath of the great and powerful Oz.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Ain't it the truth? 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 Ain't it the truth?
You're listening to the Eurofolk Radio Network here at eurofolkradio.com.
After rattlesnakes, you gotta be tough. You gotta be rough. You gotta shoot straight. Be on the lookout. The James Gang is back in town, and they're meaner than ever. There's Brother Eli. He stomped down many a snake in his day, and he ain't done yet. His younger brother Dave, quicker than a horned toad, he can hunt down a snake's lie. Then there's Sister Jean. She can whip out a scripture faster than a Colt 45. Yeah! 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 Wanted, dead or alive, they'll be coming for you. It's the James Gang on EuroFolkRadio.com.
Softly spoken in words of truth, lay foundations for the proof. Yahweh's wisdom is sublime, stands the test of time. Words are spoken from the heart. Let us now be set apart. O ye soldiers of the host, give your all and stand your post. Through the day and through the night, gird your loins and fight the fight. Draw your sword and speak your peace. Obey his laws and never cease.
Hi, this is David James with the Eurofolk Radio Network here at EurofolkRadio.com. Be sure to check out our new show, Founding Fathers, Wednesdays, 5:30 to 7 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, or 10:30 to 12 a.m. UK GMT.